Let me welcome all of you. My name is David Kramer. I am director of the library at the Jewish Theological Seminary. And we both think it our responsibility and like to have fun by examining and inviting authors from important new books of Jewish interest. So when this book by Laura Arnold Liebman came to our attention, we saw this as a perfect opportunity. The title, you know, The Art of the Jewish Family, History of Women in Early New York in Five Objects. I think it's worth saying that interest in material culture goes back a number of decades. It has attracted interest and then interest has waned. It's returned again. I've got to say that I've read a lot of books that seek to unpack the meaning and history embedded in objects. And Laura, I've never read one that's as exciting as this one. Uncovering of the lives of these women is just extraordinary. And as someone who's lived in New York for my entire adult life, I've got to say that it inspired me. The moment we can be out and about again and going to institutions, the history of which actually relates to what you wrote about, I'm going to be going there to see what I can find. I'm sure that as an author, there are many things you hope to do, but I hope that one of them is to inspire people. And I admit to being thoroughly inspired by this. I recommend it to everybody. You all got the announcement. That's why you're here. So you know the basic biographical details. I'm not going to fill that in. I will only tell you that we're in for a real treat with this presentation. And Laura and I have agreed that in the course of the presentation, Laura will take several breaks, at which point we'll have an opportunity to address questions. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please put it on chat. I'm going to mute everybody from this point forward, so your communication with us will be through the chat function. So Laura, we're really, really pleased that you've agreed to do this. And please go ahead.
Great, thank you so much, David. And thank you to everybody for coming.
Oh, we have to unmute you. Laura, unmute yourself. There. There you go. There you go, go ahead.
To say it's the curse of mute.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I couldn't mute all but, so there you go.
Totally fine. So thank you so much, Stephen, and thank you to everybody for coming this evening and for showing up virtually. And I wanted to just emphasize that we had made a decision tonight that although I'm going to be talking about just one portion of the book, I'm hoping that it will give you a sense of what's going on in the book more generally. That, as David mentioned, the book is about five different women in early New York, ranging from about 1750 to 1850. And it's really a time period where most of the biographies of Jewish women are kind of one or two lines at most, with the exception of a couple of super wealthy women who are primarily Ashkenazi, who wrote a whole bunch of materials. And so I was really going back and trying to figure out how could we start to write biographies of those women who were more average women in some sense. So the first woman is somebody who ends up very poor. Most of the Jewish women in early New York, as in most of the colonies, were quite poor, but we almost never hear about them. The second woman is a woman who was wealthier, but only six different silver cups, three of which are now at the Met. So once you are more mobile, you can go and look at her cups at the Met. The third woman is somebody who was born in Barbados and ended up in New York later in her life. And most of these women that I'm talking about, they're in New York, but not for all of their lives, right? So colonial women are very mobile and they tend to move around a fair amount. and she's an example that, and we'll see tonight how she's moving around. The fourth woman is somebody who writes her own book herself, and it's a commonplace book, which is a little bit like Facebook for the 19th century. And it's really this collection of ideas and art and poetry that other people are writing down in her book for her. And the fifth woman is somebody who has a silhouette made for her by Edouard, who's the most famous silhouette maker of the day. So those are the five women who are in the book. Tonight we decided to focus, see if it's letting me go forward. It's not liking it. I'm gonna have to escape and, for some reason it's freaking out on me. Forced quit. And we're gonna, momentary blip, and we're gonna go back and reload it because it just paused, stuck for some reason. How are people doing tonight? So this is like the curse of, this is how it goes when you're working with the technology. Something will go wrong all the time. And I always say this, the first time that I taught a digital humanities thing, somebody forgot to include the projector. And let me just say, it's very difficult to talk about digital humanities without any digital. So from there on, I always have the like idea in the back, we're gonna be doing something else. Okay, so let me see if I can move us backwards a little bit, go back and find the thing that got lost. There we go. Okay, I'm gonna share screen again. And
there we go, looks good.
So Art of the Jewish Family, five different women. David and I had decided that we were gonna focus on that woman who had began her life enslaved in Barbados and ended up one of the wealthiest women in New York. And I'm really hoping that by focusing in on her, that we can really start a bigger discussion about what's going on with Jews and race during this time period. So if you only remember, say, three different things about Sarah Brandon Moses, I sort of hope that there'll be one, I hope you remember something a little bit about Sarah, because I think she's a really interesting person, and the role that objects can help us play in creating a life story about women who, as in the case of Sarah, didn't leave behind any writing of her own. Second, I'd like you to think about how, or remember how, race was functioning differently during the time period that I'm going to be talking about than the way we think about it today. That most people, when they talk about Jews and race, really, or people who are moving from being considered one race to another, think about people passing. You may have heard of stories about people passing before. I'm really going to challenge that a little bit with Sarah and think about, it's not that she was like hiding what her race was, but the way race was being defined changes as she moves around the Atlantic world. So I'm hoping that that will help us think about like what's going on with Jews and race during this time period. And the third thing that I hope she'll help us get into a discussion about is to really think about what is that kind of hidden history of multiracial Jews in the United States. That sometimes you'll see statistics that maybe about 12% of the population of Jews in the United States today are either Hispanic or non-white or multiracial households. And interestingly enough, that's not a recent history. I think most people think, oh, that's something that happened, you know, post-Vietnam War or something like that. No, we'll see that for certain communities that Sarah lived in, about 10% of the population of that Jewish community had African ancestry. So really important to think about this larger history of diversity within the Jewish community. So let's go ahead and, why am I getting stuck again? It's so sad. Oh, it's way back. I see what's going on. Okay. We're at the end of the prezi, and that's why it's angry at us. Okay. So Sarah's life did not begin in New York. Her life began in Barbados. And I'm sure that some of you have been to Barbados, but it's an island in the southeastern part of the Caribbean. And She was born there in 1798, at the very end of the 18th century. And her father was Abraham Rodriguez Brandon, who's the wealthiest Jew on the island by the time that she dies. Her mother, on the other hand, was also born enslaved. And her mother's name changes in different documents. And fortunately, in one document, they say such and such, also known as blank, 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 which is a gold mine for a historian. Because just as you're thinking, wait, is this the same person? And somebody says, yes. So some of the time she's known as Esther Gill. Sometimes her mother known as Sarah Esther Gill. Sometimes she's known as Sarah Esther Lopez. But she was born, like her daughter Sarah, enslaved to a Sephardic family that was not the same as Sarah's father's family. So it's a different family in Barbados, the Lopez family. This particular couple has probably three children. Two of them die very young, but one of Sarah's brothers lives much longer than Sarah does even, and his name is Isaac Lopez Brandon, and he'll appear at various points during our discussion because he also is very involved in helping her move around the Atlantic world. At this point, it's hard for women to travel by themselves, so she's really dependent upon both her father and her brother in her ability to move from one place to another. Now, her father had some plantations on the western coast of the island, but both Sarah and Isaac were born in the main port in Barbados, which is Bridgetown. They lived on a street called Swan Street, though you'll see underneath it has this little thing, or Jew Street. So it was a street where many of the Jews lived. It happened to be very close to the Nida Israel Synagogue, where both Sarah's owner's family went to synagogue, and also her father went to synagogue. So her father, at various points in Sarah's lifetime, was a member of the Ma'amad, the synagogue governance board, and was even the Parnas, or president of the congregation. When Sarah was living on Swan Street, it was somewhat similar to what you would see in the Swan Street today. There was stores along the bottom row of houses, and the house that she lived in would have been on that second story with a balcony overlooking the street. And in fact, her owners were not extremely wealthy. They had a few slaves, not a tremendous number, and those slaves mainly were working in the household or were working in the shops that the family owned. So the family had two different shops. One was owned by one son and one by another. One of the sons was a silversmith and goldsmith, and the other son owned kind of a general store. And probably this general store would be of zero interest, except for by some weird twist of fate, his store record book ended up at New York Historical Society. And it turns out to be a gold mine of information about all the variety of people who lived in and among the Jewish community. And it was a really helpful resource for me, for example, for finding out what was going on with the people who were either enslaved to other Jews in the community or were related to other Jews in the Jewish community, people in the Jewish community, even though they might have been free people of color. So I want to really emphasize, Sarah's not the only person who has both African and Jewish ancestry living in Barbados at this time. So her life might have been very similar to any one of those people who are wandering around the streets, working in the stores and shops, if it weren't for an interesting fact, which is that her mother took her right after her birth to St. Michael's Church at that point, now a cathedral, and had her baptized as an Anglican. The reason why she did this was, even though Esther Gill or Sarah Esther Gill was living in a Sephardic household, in Barbados, people tended not to be converted to Judaism. So because she was not halakhically Jewish, her mother, neither Sarah nor her mother could register their births at the Jewish congregation. So instead, she took her to St. Michael's Cathedral. And I really want to emphasize this moment because it seems like it's just a religious thing. She goes to the baptismal font, which is still there, but it's also on the island a place where Reese is being placed onto Sarah's body. So to give you a sense of what I mean, I'm really relying here on two theorists, Karen and Barbara Fields, who have a book called Racecraft. And they argue that race craft is not just a euphemism for racism, but instead is this kind of evidence that racism has been on the scene. So they're interested in not race as something that I am, but something that is done to me or that I participate in. And so they're really thinking about four different ways that people place race onto other people. And those ideas are first ideas about what governs, what things that govern what goes with what and whom. So sumptuary codes, for example, how people dress, how different people must deal with each other, rituals of deference and dominance. So just as a classic example would be, who feels that they're forced to smile and be polite when they don't feel like smiling and being polite in a culture? Where human kinship begins and ends, such as bloodlines. So for example, when you register somebody's baptism, who gets to put down who their parents are and who does not? And fourth, how people look at themselves and each other, the gaze. And this too, I think, is really important for understanding why the baptism is such an important moment. Because at this moment, the people registering the baptism at the Anglican Church get to look at Sarah and decide how they want to assign race to her. So they get to decide what kind of person of color she is, and they just deem her a mulatto. And that category will then follow her for the rest of her life on the island. That's not something which is negotiable anymore. So really important that that happens. She's also assigned her father's last name. So even though he's not registered as being her father outright, that there's a hint of that kinship already going on at her birth. So again, starting to get at that theme of race as being something which is part of a social process during this time period. So her life might have been...
Laura, I just... Yes. Rachel Zeman would like you to explain how it is that Sephardi Jews came to own, slave ownership in general, and owning Jewish slaves as well.
Sure. Sephardi Jews end up being in the Caribbean through a couple different ways. One is coming directly from Iberia, and another is coming through that they'll escape Iberia and go to, for example, London or Amsterdam or Hamburg and then come to the Caribbean. And they're coming to the Caribbean, if they're coming to the British or Dutch islands, mainly for economic reasons. So they may be getting there to have some freedom of religion if they're coming directly from Iberia, but they're often there to make money. So very early on, Jews come to Barbados in part through those routes and also from Recife when it falls to the Portuguese. And the Sephardic Jews bring a lot of knowledge about how to set up sugar production and actually help instigate the growing and cultivation and production of sugar on the island. At some point, the Anglican living on the island dislike that the Jews have gotten relatively powerful in terms of the production of silver and sugar, and they limit the number of enslaved people that Jews can own. So that carries on up until close to when Sarah is born, when that is repealed, and then people can start to own more slaves. But basically, they're owning slaves in much the same way that anybody else on the island who has money owns slaves. So Jews don't proportionally own more slaves than other people, but they don't own that many less either. So it's really pretty much equivalent to what else is going on the island. Does that help, or?
Yes, that's great. Go ahead.
Perfect. Okay. So her life probably would have been the same as any of these other people who are floating around Bridgetown, except for two pretty radical things happened to her in 1801. So she's only 3 years old, and suddenly her life is changing dramatically. And the first thing that happens is her mother's father, who happens to be white and Anglican, dies. And he leaves his enslaved children a house just a couple blocks away from where Sarah and her brother live. And this means that suddenly the people in Sarah's family who had been enslaved and couldn't purchase their freedom suddenly have a means to begin to do that. And that location of that church also, that house ends up being important because it's right next to where in the 1820s, Anglican church is built that's for the elite members of the free African Barbadian community. So it ends up being very strategically located for helping Sarah and her family sort of move forward in terms of status. The other thing that that house is near and ends up being important and was something that came out as I started researching the half of Sarah's ancestry that came through slavery was that Sarah's mother's sister-in-law, so Sarah's aunt, is this woman named Anne Gill. And she is the most famous woman in early Barbados. So she is a member of the early Methodist Church. She breaks away from the Anglicans and she's agitating for rights for free people of color and enslaved people of color to be able to worship freely. That ended up being really interesting to me because Sarah's own brother ends up being very much a part of agitating for rights for Jews on the island as well. So we see that in her family history, she's got this incredible, rich source of background of people agitating for the rights of free people of color in order for them to be able to worship openly. That's something that ends up being kind of biting her brother on the butt a little bit because he ends up getting kicked out of the synagogue in Barbados as a result. And he follows her later to New York where he ends up having better luck. So very important that that part of her family ends up being so powerful. So just as a little recap here, we have Sarah, here's her brother. They had two other sisters that seem to have died early. They're talked about in early records and then they disappear. So we assume that they passed away. Here's her father, Abraham Rodriguez Brandon, her mother, Sarah Esther Gill, her aunt, and then here's her Anglican white grandfather. So we know both the name of her grandmother, who is Jemima Lopez, who is also enslaved to the Lopez family. And there's also a great-grandmother named Deborah, who is also enslaved to the Lopez family. So that is her family. So there's this first big thing. She ends up getting freed. This part of her family inherits this incredible house. They suddenly have much more status. The second big thing that happens when she's 3 years old is that her father takes her back over to St. Michael. I'm going to mute you right now. Maybe David, can you mute her? Maybe I did it. Okay. So her father takes her back to St. Michael's Cathedral, and he both pays money to Sarah's owner, Hannah Esther Lopez, and pays money to the Anglicans so that he can make sure that his children will no longer be enslaved. So he has them manumitted. And that really is very unusual on the island and really changes her ability in terms of what she can do going forward. So at the age of 3, she now is somebody who is, somehow we got out of sync. Let me move this forward. Okay, so at the age of 3, she's somebody who has suddenly become part of this free people of color community. She's still Anglican, and she would have always sort of existed at the margins of the Jewish community in Barbados because it was very hard to become part of the Jewish community by conversion in Barbados. So around 1811, she and her brother decide enough is enough, and they decide they want to become halakhically or legally Jewish. And in order to do that, they decide to leave the island and travel to a nearby community in Suriname. So I'm going to pause here for a second. Does anybody have any questions that need to be answered before we move on to Suriname?
Go ahead.
Is Suriname Dutch at this point?
Great question. Suriname, this is part of the reason why they go to Suriname. Suriname is in a weird little moment where it's actually owned by the British. So it's a little interim period just for a couple of decades where it's under British control. So there's a lot of traffic back and forth between Barbados and Suriname during this time period.
Yeah, Aliza asks, just to read, when her ancestors arrived in Barbados, how did they get there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we don't know. So I was able to trace back her ancestry four generations. Her great-grandmother, Deborah Lopez, is still being described as being of partial African and partial British ancestry. So sometime before that, but we don't actually know. So sometime before maybe the 1750s is my guess is when her ancestors would have come to Barbados on from Africa. But we don't know that information. It's a great question. And I wish I knew more, but I was really pleased that I found it as much as I did. So any other questions before we move forward?
No, I think we can go forward. We can go on.
Okay. Great. So most of you probably today, if you had to pick a place that you would go to if you needed to convert to become Jewish, even if it were owned by the British, you probably wouldn't have chosen Suriname. So I think it bears some question of like, why? Why would you go to Suriname even though it's nearby? So Suriname, normally Dutch, now it's become British. It's home to the second largest, maybe first largest, depending on the date, Jewish community in all of the Americas, which means it's got way more infrastructure than a place like Barbados or even New York during this time period. So it's going to take quite a while until New York is at the same scale as Suriname. So during early Surinamese history, there's maybe eight ritual circumcisers in Suriname. It's just a really, at a time where people in the U.S. colonies would have been struggling to get a moil to come and visit. So really different scenario. They have multiple synagogues. They also have schools, which are just much more established than other places. So in that sense, really logical to go there. The other reason why it's logical to go there is part of the interesting history of Suriname, which has to do with a town that was set up very early in the history called Yodensavanna. So Yodensavanna is downriver from Paramaribo, which is the main port up here. And Yodensavanna is the first semi-autonomous Jewish community in the Americas. So it's the first place where Jews get to decide, I want to set up a town, I want to set it up a particular way. And they set it up to imitate how Jerusalem was founded in the Bible. So they put the synagogue up on the tallest hill. They put it at the center of four different crossroads, and they lay out the rest of the town like the tents around the tabernacle. So very similar to how New Haven was set up for the exact same reasons. And in addition to doing all those sort of moments of like, we're the new Jerusalem, they also start trying to follow the biblical laws regarding slavery, which means they start both converting and circumcising slaves and making them part of the Jewish community. So by the time that Sarah and her brother arrive in Suriname, there have been descendants of people from Africa for generation upon generation who are halakhically Jewish. So they're not people who have recently converted, but are ongoing generations of people. And about 10% of the community are multiracial Jews in Suriname at this point.
So Laura, I'm sorry, I lost a question on the scrolling of the chat, and several people pointed it out. So there was a confusion. This is from Judah Rosen. I'm not sure I understand the question, but I'll just read it exactly.
David, can I
ask? Oh, please, go right ahead, yes.
So the question is, if her father was a free white Jewish man, and her mother was a black non-Jewish slave, but her owners were a white Jewish family. I mean, it would make sense if her father was the white Jew who owned her, but it's not the white Jew who owned her. It's a separate white Jewish man. So did families lend out their slaves to other families for sex? And the fact that it wasn't just one child, he had more than one child with her. So it's kind of, I don't get it. She belonged to one family, but she was having sex with another family.
So, Judah, I think this is like a very poignant question, and it gets at the heart of what makes it really difficult to work about families during this time period. So 100% that one of the things that people complain about is that women in particular who own slaves, and by the time that Sarah's born, her owner is a widow. So she's owned by a single woman. And women apparently did lend out their slaves in order basically to for white men to rape, essentially, right? So it's very difficult for us to know what that relationship was between Sarah's mother and her father. They had a number of kids together. They remained very, very dedicated, but I'm loath to assume that it was an equal partnership, right? That we don't know to what extent she was free to be able to make the choice of who she was with. And so certainly by having her daughter baptized, that allows her daughter potentially to one day have a marriage in an Anglican church, which would allow her a different kind of relationship than her mother was actually able to have. So I think it's a really good question. That's just typical in Barbados during this time period. And something, it's not particular to Jews, it's something across the city that's a problem. So thank you for that question.
Thank you.
Any other questions like that before we go back to Suriname?
I think we can go back to Suriname. And while we do that, I want to thank Tybel for sharing a link to jewishvirtuallibrary.org, their virtual Jewish history tour of Suriname.
Yes, and there's also a brand new book by Aviva Ben-Ur, who's a fantastic scholar of Jewish Suriname that just came out. And if somebody reminds me, I'll put the link into her book in the chat when I'm done with the presentation. But I haven't read it yet, but she's such a fantastic scholar. I can't imagine that it's not going to be great, great, great. So Suriname. So this term, Yodin Savana, we have these multi-generations of people with mixed Jewish and African ancestry becoming part of the community. So it makes a lot of sense that when Sarah and Isaac are looking for a place to convert, they're going to a place not only that has an established Jewish community, but that is open to people with African ancestry converting. So by the time that they arrive, Yodin Savana is kind of falling into disrepair, and most of the Jews have relocated up to Paramaribo in the main port. So Paramaribo is again still along that same river, and most of the Jews are living along the waterfront. Some of the wealthier people are living in these sort of beautiful mansions. One of these houses was also owned by the Jewish community and was where poor members of the community could live. So very much taking care of the rest of the community. The other thing that was interesting about Paramaribo is it had not one, but two or three synagogues, depending on the time period. The first of these was the Portuguese synagogue, which is over here, and the second one is the Ashkenazi one, and I'll mention the third one in a moment. So when Sarah and Isaac, her brother Isaac, go there, they specifically go to the Portuguese community, so the Sephardic community. Those of you who have been to Israel may have seen the interior of this synagogue in the Israel Museum, but during this time period, being a Sephardic Jew was much classier than being an Ashkenazi Jew. And the Sephardic Jews had a lot of regulations trying to keep a boundary between them and the Ashkenazi Jews. So because Sarah's father is Sephardic, she's able to have a conversion, become what they call a member of the Nassau, so a member of the Jewish Portuguese nation. So there's the interior that some people may have seen at the Israel Museum. So after being allowed to convert, her brother it's recorded in the minutes for the synagogue, he was allowed to be circumcised by one of those many moilim, and then they go down the stairs in the small house behind the synagogue where underneath a trapdoor there is a ritual bath, and you can see it's all dried out today, but at the time it would have been full of water. And both of them immerse and say the blessings and become members of the Jewish, the Hebrew Portuguese Jewish nation. So, and in contrast, they could have gone to this other very large synagogue around the corner, but they do not. And I think it's very important to know that one of the things that's driving them not going there is that Ashkenazi Jews are just not considered quite as good. And we'll see this happening as a motif through the rest of Sarah's life. So at this point, the two congregations have rejoined, and this is where Jews in Suriname all Jews in Suriname are going to synagogue, but at the time there was this big divide between them. In fact, such a divide that if you were a Sephardic Jew and you married an Ashkenazi Jew, you would get demoted to being a lesser status, and you could no longer be called up to the Torah to read. You'd have to sit in the bad seats over in the back of the synagogue, and you would be buried in the swampy section of the cemetery. So a lot of pressure not to marry those low-class Ashkenazi Jews. In addition, you know, the Ashkenazi Jews then said, like, well, then we'll demote you, and had the same motif in back to them. However, it wasn't just marrying an Ashkenazi Jew that would allow you to be demoted. This could also happen if you married somebody who had partial African ancestry. So one of the strange innovations that we see happening in Suriname is, on the one hand, they're being very inclusive and allowing in people with African ancestry into the community, but they're also following the same sort of regulations that we saw happening in the Barbados church or happening in the Dutch Reform churches around this congregation, where suddenly they're marking the race of the people who are partaking in different ceremonies in the synagogue. So here we see an early ketubah of a Jewish man named Ishmael Judo and Hannah DeMatos, who were married in 1729. We see his lovely signature here. And one of the things early on that it says in the ketubah is that both of them are emancipated Jews. And this is a euphemism for saying that they're free people of color. So very important that they're marking them here as being free people of color. And if somebody then married one of their children who had been a European Jew, that person would be demoted again, swampy section of the cemetery, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine that the Jews of color who lived in Suriname were not so thrilled with this policy. And at some point, they got fed up and they decided, you know what? We could have our own congregation and we could stop all this nonsense and we could bury people with honors who are important members of the congregation who happen to have African ancestry. And they began a third congregation called Darhe Yesharim, which was over on Silva Plain in Paramaribo, so just around the corner. And this congregation went on for a couple of decades until finally the other two Jewish congregations petitioned to the Dutch government to have it disbanded. They didn't like the fact that the Jews of color had circumvented their prohibitions and were now having the same honors as everybody else. And the entire congregation was disbanded. It later burned down. And they had, by the time that Sarah and her brother had arrived in Paramaribo, all the people who had been members of Darhe Yesharim had to rejoin the other congregations. So all of this, I think, is a really good reminder of that issue of how race is playing into this question of Jewishness. All these regulations are very much in opposition to Jewish law, which is a Jew is a Jew. But here we see this influence of what's going on in the churches feeding into what's happening in the synagogue as well. The other thing that I think is really important that we could get out of what's going on in Suriname is maybe hints at why Sarah and her brother don't decide to just stay in Suriname. Comes from a portrait which is now in the Rijksmuseum, which is often presented as being the first portrait of a multiracial couple from early Suriname. And this is a woman named Maria Luisa de Hart and her husband. They were, her father was the parnas of that big Ashkenazi synagogue. And although people today will often mark them as being multiracial, according to Surinamese law, if your parents married, you actually, if you had seven white grandparents and your parents were married, you were actually white, not a person of color. So early in her life, Maria Luisa de Hart, pictured here, would have been marked in records as being a person of color. When her parents marry when she's in her 20s, that changes and suddenly she becomes a free white person. So very important that our categories are not the same as the categories, and had Maria Luisa de Hart lived in Barbados, she always would have been a person of color. So racial designations are different at the different places that they move. So perhaps it's because of these stigmas that, in spite of the fact that it would have been very helpful for Sarah if her parents had married in Suriname, her parents do not. So Sarah's parents do not marry. She would have remained a person of color in Suriname. And eventually she and her brother grow tired of Suriname and leave. And her brother goes back to Barbados. And Sarah, after a couple of years, travels on to a third location, which is London. And I'm going to pause here and see if there's any questions about any of what I've talked about so far.
I don't see anything on the chat. Is there anybody who has a question verbally?
Hi, it's slightly peripheral, so feel free to whatever. But when you were talking, I was reminded of the book by the journalist Isabel Vincent, The Bodies and Souls, about looking at women, Jewish women forced into prostitution. And the part of it was specifically about how the pimps had their own synagogues, like the social stratification. And I just wondered if you had any comment. I know it's peripheral.
No, I should definitely go read that. I haven't read it, so I don't know anything about that. But so I think there definitely, I know for people who work on both Mexico and Argentina, there's really interesting intersections between the histories of Jewish women being forced to come to the colonies and forced into prostitution. And so I think there's a really important work that's being done right now of thinking about how gender and sexuality are at this intersection of what's going on with Judaism and things that maybe were taboo for a while and people didn't want to talk about. So I'll have to read that book, but thank you. Okay, so I'm going to move on to London.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Totally.
So was it unusual that she and her brother decided to convert even though their mother wasn't Jewish?
So for Barbados, completely unusual. In fact, they're the only people I know of in Barbados who ended up doing that path of going to Suriname and then converting. In Suriname, very typical for the time period that they're in that would have happened. So it makes me wonder to what extent the fact that there's more traffic back and forth between Barbados and Suriname in those years makes them more aware that if they were just living someplace else, they would have different opportunities. So it's a really good question. The ability to convert varies tremendously by location. Any other questions?
Let's go ahead.
Okay, on to London. So around 1815, Sarah ends up traveling to London, probably with her father, and they end up becoming affiliated with Bevis Marks, the Portuguese synagogue, which should make sense at this point because both her father is Portuguese, and now Sarah is officially a member of the Nassau, the Hebrew Jews of the Portuguese nation. But when she goes there, she also does something that's very typical of super fancy Sephardic West Indian Jews, which is instead of staying in the city proper, she goes slightly south of the city to Peckham to a very elite Sephardic boarding school. So this is a place where the Montefiores and the Barrows, the people who are like the hoity-toity Jews of the West Indies, send their Sephardic children to the school to learn to be Sephardic elites. So this education is really a place where Sarah's learning both the languages that she needs to be a member of the Jewish elite. So not just Hebrew, but she needs to be able to speak Spanish and Portuguese to be fluent in what's going on in the synagogue. In addition, she's learning the niceties of being an upper class lady. So she's learning how to have servants, not how to be a servant. So a lot of the rituals for the girls from this time period we know involve giving these sort of acts of charity to people around the town. So how to be somebody who's beneficent to the other people in the community as opposed to receiving of charity all the time. So really important for her transformation. The other thing that happens while she's in London is that her portrait is made. So I'm going to take just a few minutes to talk about the portrait. I hope you'll be interested in it. There's lots more in the book on it. But this is a very small miniature. It's about this big, so just about 2 1/4 inches high. And it's made out of very fragile material. So it's made from ivory, from an elephant's tusk, painted, and you can see here a man painting with watercolors on this very small little miniature. And you can see that the style here, this is sort of a lovely miniature because it's a miniature itself, but it's of a man painting a miniature as well. So you can see that he's got the woman styled as if she's a neoclassical sculpture that's being echoed in the background. And this is very much a moment where these ivory miniatures are indebted to this rise of racial science during this time period and this notion of neoclassical elegance. So very much about a kind of cult of whiteness that's arising. So as I said, they cut sheets of elephant's tusk and then are using various processes to make the sheet almost translucent or transparent because it's so thin, and the way that they're using a hot iron on it in order to bring out that sort of glowiness of the ivory. Some of the time, in order to get that sort of luminescence out of the ivory, they'll even put a piece of silver right behind the skin of the person so that you get that reflection of the light through the ivory and sort of echoed back through it. So this is a close-up of a detail of the portrait of her brother, and you can see how the face itself is having that just bare ivory with the light coming through and emphasizing sort of the glowingness of the skin. So very much what these miniatures are about. The reason why they're using the watercolor on them is at first people tried using oil paints, but the oil paint completely obscures what's going on with the ivory, and you sort of lose all the beauty of the ivory. Like, the whole point of the ivory is that glowing lusciousness of it. You lose that once you use those other paints. But it turns out there's also kind of a problem with using ivory in that it's really hard to get watercolor to stick to the ivory. So they develop kind of two strategies for doing that. One is what is called stippling, which is these small little dots of paint, which is what people tend to use on faces so you still get the glow of the ivory coming through and the whiteness of the skin. And the second one is something that you tend to see used more for hair or for background or for clothing, which is called hatching, which are these little sort of brush marks like this. So you can start to see the way we think about ivory miniatures has changed radically in the past 10 years because of digital photography. So basically before, we had a much rougher idea of what was going on with it. It's really changed the way we think about it. So one of the things that I'm really interested in the book is how the strategies of applying paint in Sarah's miniature differ from other multiracial portraits of women from the Atlantic world from this time period. So here's a woman of partial African ancestry from early Suriname. Here's a woman who was originally from Haiti but moves to early New York. Her time in New York overlaps with Sarah. And you can see that the two artists for these miniatures have done something a little bit devious and nasty, which is instead of using the technique that you're supposed to get at the beauty of skin, they've used that hatching strategy on the skin. So I would argue this is racecraft, right? Like, this is that moment where everybody has a skin color, but here the person is deliberately making the skin look flawed and associating darker skin with being flawed as opposed to with beauty. So really important that this is not the strategy that's being used in Sarah's portrait. And you can see that even when you're a little bit farther back from the miniatures, that you still get that weird scratchiness look. I have to say, like, if I were one of these women, I think I would have told the artist to redo my portrait. But it's a relatively famous portrait artist. Very interestingly enough, this artist in particular ends up going to South America after this and painting members of the revolution. And he changes his strategy for how he deals with darker skin when he gets to Latin America. So really important that he's being very strategic. This is a strategy that you're not supposed to use on women and is really a statement about how he's interpreting their skin color. Again, not what we see going on in Sarah's portrait. The person is using a very delicate dot technique, that stippling that we were talking about before. So the second thing that I think is really important about Sarah's portrait has to do with those sumptuary laws. So you'll notice that Sarah looks a little bit like she's coming out of a Jane Austen novel, and that's because she's got one of these Empire waist dresses that's so popular. And in fact, you can date when her portrait is based on the style of her dress. Like, those dress styles are very specific to time. So really 1815 is the date for this. So this is a dress style which is coming out of and modeled upon what the Empress Josephine is doing, so Napoleon's wife, somebody who's very much associated with Jewish emancipation during this time period. So there's these interesting resonances for Jewish women wearing these dresses during this time period. It's neoclassical, but also a sign of Jewish participation in the larger civic world. I would say also wearing a white flimsy dress speaks of freedom, right? Because that is not a dress you can do housework in, or you would be expected to do housework in. So it's really a statement about her ability to have her time to herself and her lack of need to do any kind of physical labor. The third thing I think is really interesting about this portrait, and you'll notice this is the Empress Josephine. This is a woman, a Jewish woman from the northern colonies. You'll notice both of them have much lower cut dresses than Sarah does. And I think this is something that's really important to think about in terms of Sarah's life as somebody coming out of the Caribbean. So in the colonies where Sarah was born and previously lived, there were sumptuary laws that said women who had certain elements of African ancestry could not fully cover their chests. So for Sarah, there's really a saying of racial status and privilege to be covered as opposed to be exposed. And I do think it's really important that she's then covering herself in this portrait. So having had that portrait made, she returns to Bevis Marks Synagogue with her father, and her portrait, these portraits are often exchanged as part of courting rituals, meets another portrait of a young Jew who happens to be named Joshua Moses, and they are wed at Bevis Marks Synagogue. Now, this is a sort of interesting match for a number of reasons. Joshua Moses, like Sarah at this point, is incredibly wealthy. So Sarah's father has given her a 10,000 pound dowry, which has the buying ability of about $30 million today. So he's put a lot of money into making her somebody who's going to marry well and give him good descendants. But Joshua Moses' father is also like the phenomenal match for the two men, because his father is the most important merchant in New York, and her father is the most important merchant in the premier sugar colony. This is like a trade network made in heaven. So very important that both the patriarchs are benefiting from this. The other thing I think, though, is interesting in the subtext of this is it's right after the regulations where at Bevis Marks, Sephardic Jews could not marry Ashkenazi Jews, and Joshua Moses is an Ashkenazi Jew. So he, in the Bevis Marks world, is marrying up, that he has now got this better genealogy than his family had by having his descendants have the Sephardic prestige that he didn't have. So she's bringing a lot to the match, he's bringing a lot to the match. It's a good partnership. Right after they marry, they rent a house very close to the synagogue. But within a year, she is pregnant, and they decide to move back to New York. They settle on the lower part of Manhattan, close to the synagogue. So this red house is Joshua's parents' house. This is Sarah and Joshua's house. Her brother, at this point, has gotten fed up with the Barbados congregation and moves to New York and becomes business partners with her husband. So he becomes part of this network and in the fold. And within 10 years, she and her husband have 10 children, including two sets of twins, nine of which live to be adults. And unfortunately, Sarah dies right after the birth of the last set of twins when she is 28. Okay, I'm hearing a little rattling from people. Any questions before I close up? Any questions before I conclude?
I'm asking if you don't want to go.
Did Sarah's father have another family? Did he have a legal wife and children by her?
Fantastic. Judy, you're the man of many great questions. So he did not. So he does not have another woman that he recognizes to the same extent as Esther Gill until after Esther Gill dies. So Esther comes to New York in the early 20s, 1820s, and gets a very fancy house just down the street from Sarah. And she dies of the flu one March in 1823. And it's not till after that he takes up with another woman who the descendants have family lore that they married in Jamaica. The records from Abraham Rodriguez Brandon himself suggest no, that it seems that he never married her either. But he does have a second set of children with her, and they go on and become members of the Jewish community after his death in England.
Could you explain, her father went to London, so when she went to London, she was in London with her father?
Yeah, so her father, like many of the merchants, travels around, so it's pretty normal. I think my thought about, frankly, before I worked on Jews in early America, I worked on Native American communities in early New England, so both my dissertation and first book were on that. And let me just say, for colonists, Jews are very mobile. They're constantly moving around. So he's got business in London. I've got a lot of records of him moving around on different ships. So he's in London doing business, and he brings Sarah with him and puts her in school there.
That explains where her money came from, because that was my earlier question was, how did she suddenly have this money for this lifestyle as a young woman in London?
Yes. So when she's born, he's kind of like a Jew. Like, he's not like so important in the community. He's sort of on the rise. But by the time that she goes to London, he's really made it pretty big. So by the time he dies, a few years after she does, he is the wealthiest Jew on the island. So he's a very important merchant.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to finish up then. So interestingly, when the census takers come around to ask about her family, even though there are members of the Jewish community who absolutely know about Sarah's early ancestry, so her husband goes to Talmud Torah with one of the grandsons of her former slave owner. It's not like there aren't Barbadians everywhere she lives who know about her early history. Her family becomes incredibly important in Sherith Israel. A couple of her sons end up being Parnas, that is president of Sherith Israel. Israel, her son, is an early surgeon at the Jewish hospital. Her other sons are Civil War heroes. Her son Lionel marries Selena Satius, who's the granddaughter of Gershom Mendes Satius, and they have a large number of offspring. So her family becomes very integral in the synagogue, and in spite of her brother having had problems in Barbados, in New York, he is accepted as a full member of the congregation, and members of the congregation help him get U.S. citizenship. So not only can he vote in the synagogue, but he can also vote in U.S. elections as well. So they become very integral in terms of what's going on. So what could this story tell us about Jewish American history more broadly? Historian Osman Murray really says that history becomes dangerous when it starts to unsettle the dust of the past. So I'm really interested in how the stories that we tell about the past can make us rethink what we think we know about today. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the stories about people shifting their race as they moved or over the course of their lives in early America tend to be told as the stories of passing. But that idea of passing implies somebody is one race and they're just pretending not to be it and nobody knows. But again, not the case for Sarah. People know from every place she lives what happens. I'm going to mute you, Danny, because I'm getting a little competition here. Okay, so everywhere she goes, people are knowing what the story is, and yet she's still having her race be reassigned as white. So I really want us to think about how racial categories are this social construct during this time period, at least for people who have a lot of money and who are very mobile and have this sort of ambiguous racial assignment to begin with. The second thing that I think is really important is just thinking about how objects like that portrait are part of this system of racecraft during this time period. So how clothing and how portraits that people get made, and even marriage contracts are part of this negotiation of how different communities assign race and how race gets crafted for different people. So I think it's a really important idea also about how we think about kinship. That I mentioned at the beginning that racecraft often involves these questions of like who belongs with whom and who is and is related to what person. But Jewish law really says no, a Jew's a Jew, and there is no Jewish DNA, which science would tell us to, in spite of what the DNA tests seem to keep on telling us. So early American Jews really find themselves in dialogue with how other people in the colonies are constructing race. And stepping back and thinking about how those family histories get written can help us think about how race is being crafted in early America. That said, I think it can also help us think about how we perhaps continue to craft race with our own categories or even when we're doing genealogy. So I've tended to talk about Sarah, her mother, as being multiracial, and that seems to suggest that somehow her father is not, that somehow he's, because he's accepted as white, that somehow all of his known ancestors are Sephardic. Yet by the time that his family fled Iberia, it was really a pretty rare family that had no old Christian ancestors in it. So I would say if DNA tests, if DNA tests tell us anything, they'll show that various groups of Jews resemble people who are in the regions around them, right? So like, you know that your ancestors are from Iberia or Germany or Russia or different from other Jews because in part they resemble the communities that they live among, right? So they've shared DNA either because of intermarriage or because of illicit sexual encounters or because of conversion. For all these various reasons, Jews resemble the different groups that they're among. So Abraham Rodriguez Brand, in that sense, like all Jews, are just as interracial as Sarah. It's just that we're choosing to believe the story of him as being purely Sephardic and not to mark him as interracial, or maybe not to mark ourselves that way. So I just want to encourage people to think about how that myth of the pure Jew, of like who is the full Jew, is also part of the legacy of racecraft. And for all of us, as we start to think about ourselves as members of Jewish communities or as teachers or as scholars, or as just people who are interested in being inclusive, that sort of discourse is part of this legacy that we bear from this early colonial period. So thank you. I'm gonna go ahead and stop sharing my screen, and I'm happy to take more questions from people. I've talked you all out. You have no more questions.
Laura? Hi, can you tell us a tiny bit about the other figures in the book or the other objects? Even half a sentence about each one?
Sure.
And thank you.
Yeah, sure. So I'll show you a little picture of the book. So the book, just as a proselytizing of it, they did a lovely job with it. It's all in, they did all color images, and it's heavily subsidized, so it's fairly cheap for an academic book. It's paper. Hardback, but still only $30. But the other four women are all women who also lived in New York at least part of their lives. And one of the things I'm kind of interested over the course of it, you'll see she has this huge dowry and she's creating these kind of economic binds. The women at the different points kind of go from somebody who's very much what we'd call the yoke mates version of things, all the way up to people who are marrying for love. So we sort of see a shift over this time period in terms of kinship. the first object that I look at is a bank, what's called a begging letter. And it's written by a woman named Hannah Lusada, who was one of these widows who, after her husband dies, falls on very hard times and has to continually ask the congregation for more money. So it's pretty rare that we have one of these letters, and I'm really interested in teasing out why is it that we don't have letters from these women, even though they make up the majority of the population. So why don't we have more records from them during this time period? So that's the first chapter. The second chapter is about Rena Levy Moses, who's actually Joshua Moses' mother. So there's a little bit of a family connection going on. And she is the niece of Meyer Myers, who's a really famous Jewish silversmith. And she, when she got married, got a set of 6 cups made by Meyer Myers. And again, I'm kind of interested in this transformation of the cups over time from being something she owned to being something that she passes on to her children. And we know the legacy of the cups from what's inscribed on them to being something that ends up in museums and becomes part of a museum collection, and how objects change sort of their biography. So it's her biography, also the object's biography. Third one is Sarah, who you just heard about. The fourth one is a woman named Sarah Ann Hayes Mordecai, who wrote a commonplace book, which is again kind of like Facebook for the 19th century, or a scrapbook for the 19th century. It's very interactive, and it's a book that she worked on her entire life. She is an author as well. She writes the first biography of Rebecca Gratz, but is pretty much unknown for it during her lifetime. It's not until later that people are like, hey, that biography was kind of helpful. So really interested in thinking about how the network's emotional ties between people in it allow her to create this sense of community. She marries a man who's in the military. He's from the South. The Civil War hits. He has to make a choice whether he's going to continue to fight with the North, which is where he's been stationed, or he's going to leave and go fight for the South. He asks, could they just transfer him to California? The military says, no, you can't just go to California. And he ends up quitting. And his wife and her daughters end up having to support him until he gets back on his feet by teaching. So it really, you see the sort of support network that she's built playing out in terms of who she falls back on when she falls on hard times. And the fifth one is a woman who also began her life very poor in London. She was an orphan. She lives very close to where Sarah was living in London. And she marries her teacher and is a very young girl and comes to America, and he becomes the first big Ashkenazi rabbi in America, in the United States, in New York. And so he starts the first Jewish newspaper in New York, and later there's pretty soon after she arrives, there is the piece which is on the cover. I'll show you again in a moment, but there's a silhouette made of, thank you, David. So that's part of the silhouette that's made of her. She looks like she's my age in there, or maybe a little older. She's only 21 in that picture. So it really has to do with like how she's got her hat, the kind of hat that she's wearing. So I'm really interested in what we can figure out about hairstyles and hat styles from what's going on with them, with the silhouette.
Okay, Laura, I'm conscious of the time, and we don't want to take advantage of you. I just looked at the number of people who are still hanging out, and you've retained virtually everyone. And those who logged off only at the very end after you were finished your major presentation. So that's a tribute to the interest of what you presented.
I recognize it's late there for you, though, so.
Not so late. I mean, yeah, I know it looks like it's dark around me, but it's just because I forgot to turn on other lights in the room. I mean, you raised so many fascinating questions about race, about Jews and race, about you modeled how to interpret objects in ways that expose far more than most of us are attentive to. And it really helps us to ask questions. I was about to say, imagine this is just one chapter of the book. You've just reviewed the others, and people can imagine what other kinds of questions are raised. So let me come back to what I said at the beginning and recommend to all of you that you purchase the book the way books are purchased. Laura and I tried to figure out if there was a way to do book sales and signing, but given the world we're living in now, that didn't seem like something we could do. But I do have to say, I want to thank everybody for coming on behalf of the Library of JTS. And the new JTS Library is finishing its construction as we speak. We are planning to move the collections back very, very shortly. And as it becomes possible for you to visit us, for us to open our doors with our new rare book room and galleries and the like, I want to invite you to come and visit us. As you spoke, Laura, I thought of quickly of two items in our rare collection. One is a Seder Brachot, a book of blessings that was printed in Amsterdam in 1684, and it includes in it a ceremony in Hebrew and Portuguese for the conversion of slaves. So, you know, I mean, it raises interesting issues. It's clear they're following biblical law. I would be happy to show that to anyone who can make their way to our newly opened rare book room. We also have a Moel book, the record of circumcisions done from this very same period by an active Moel in Barbados.
That is the slave owner's son, the one who owned this, that is his book. So
there's much to be discovered, and I want to thank you all, and we will invite you to other book talks, some of them remotely, even if we are open, because it's nice to be able to bring in this many people from these great distances. So come back in the fall. And last but not least, I got a question, someone who wanted to know how you can access the recording of this. When I finish processing the recording, I'll share it with our video department at JTS and it will be posted online. If you're interested, we can send out a notice to those who have participated just so that you know it's available. So Laura, thank you so much. And thank you everybody for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I noticed somebody was asking about the Jewish Book Council. I did sign up to do the Jewish Book Council this year. So apparently I'm speaking for free. If people want me to speak to like your community center or whatever, I'm part of the Jewish Book Council this year with this book. So
excellent.
And we can include a link to, you can buy it on Amazon or directly from University of Chicago Press is the distributor.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you so
good night.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.